Hello, this is The Link Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com in channel pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. Want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
And we're back.
This is the Linux Show for January the 14th, 2003. Welcome back, everybody. Hello to everybody in the IRC that I've been chatting with for the last half hour. We're back for another weekly episode of the Linux Show. Seems I'm getting a little static on my phone. Let me see if I can adjust it a little better. There we go. But we're going to go ahead and jump right into the show, and we'll do introductions on the fly because I am personally a little short on time this evening. I need to take off as soon as I possibly can. Had a death in my family, and so my participation in the show is going to be very short this evening. I do want to make one announcement to our regular listeners, and that is we're asking for a little bit of support out of you. This is going to be easy. It's not going to take much effort on your part at all. What we want you to do is go to our website. You should know the address. You're probably there right now, www.linuxshow.com. And there is a new link on the website. There will be a button covering this link on the website sometime in the next day or two. But if you look on our links list right on the front page, you will see in the middle of that a new domain registrations link. And we have contracted to do domain registrations reasonably cheaply. Not super cheap, but reasonably cheap. And what we're asking people to do is tell their friends, or if you have a domain that you need to register, please go to that registration tool and do us the favor of registering your domain or transferring your domain to us. We are giving some pretty reasonable perks in terms of free forwarding, free parking, a number of other things.
Like Bullforge, because I own Bullforge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
so you get a special. Linux Show gets a cut of the deal for registering domains.
That's the whole deal. We get about $1.50 for new domains and about $1 for transfers. And our hope is that the domain registration service is going to, over time, if you are regular listeners, tell your friends about this, that we might be able to cover our very expensive phone bill, at least partially, with this service. It's something that we all need to do, is to keep our domain names updated, or if you're in the mood to register a new one. We are, in conjunction with this, having a little bit of a special a sale. If you are in need of a domain just for fun, we are registering new domains under the .us and the .biz TLD for only $7. And we still get, about $1 for registering those two TLDs. Got a special deal with the owners of the owners that own that particular country registrar. So at least for about a month and a half, we have those two TLDs on sale. So please, please pass this along to all your friends so that we can help underwrite some of the costs of bringing this very fine show to you.
That's for a regular .net, .com, .org registration.
Pardon?
How much for a regular .net, .com, .org?
$9.99 for a new domain, $7.77 for a transfer.
That is cheap as cheap can be.
No, it's not. You can always find another price cheaper.
Yeah, probably not too much cheaper.
Not too much, but, you know, we wanted to give a reasonable value and still make a couple bucks. And hopefully, I know there's a number of people who are listeners to the show fairly regularly that do own ISPs. And that's really what I'm hoping for, is one or two of the ISPs will do a couple of big bulk transfers to us, and, you know, transfer a couple hundred domain names at a time, because that would really go a long way to underwriting the cost of our phone service for a month or two, for sure. But anyways, it's there, folks. Please take advantage of us, advantage of the service to help us out. This show is not cheap to produce, and basically the advertising that we do for the vendors, we're doing for free, just to promote the Linux industry. So on to the first segment of the show. I'm going to go ahead and jump right over to Russ, because I know Russ, looking at our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, you have a whole bunch of stories that are in the show links list for tonight. And so could you go ahead and take it away?
Sure thing. The first story tonight that I have is from the Boston Globe, a little piece called Lindo's Case Goes Beyond Business. And I would just mention for folks who may not have the Linux Show webpage up in front of them, which you should anyway, but you can find all of these stories over on Linux Today as well, linked from there. So that's another shortcut. But this is an interesting little piece, which just rehashes a bit of the controversy over the Lindo's name and the battle with Microsoft. The key point that I see in this, of course, is that they are believing that the court may make a ruling very soon, even before the court case is supposed to begin in April, as to whether or not the word Windows is a trademarkable term. And of course, the story goes into other facets of the Windows controversy, and I happen to know that Jeff has some particular opinions on this.
Yeah, I do. I want to express my opinion because I want to get out of here as soon as possible. First of all, on the news item itself, I do believe, and I don't have the link in front of me, but I do believe there was a court case that goes back to the release of Windows 2.0. So a long fucking time ago, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well over 10 or 12 years, probably close to 15 years ago is my guess. But somewhere out there is a news story in our ancient history about Apple suing Microsoft for copyright infringement on the word Windows. And Apple lost their copyright battle. And Microsoft was allowed to use the word Windows in the creation of their trademark. And so when Microsoft's trademark was originally granted, it wasn't the fact that they were granted a trademark on the word Windows. They were granted a trademark on an image of the word Windows, if you follow what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's precedent against Microsoft in this case, and that has been primarily the reason why I think that Windows has had the reasonable success that they have against Microsoft up to this point. I could be dead wrong, but I'm not a lawyer. But I got another take on this that it really sort of, pisses me off. And first of all, if people who are out there do take a look at this Boston Globe article, I want people to really carefully read the article. The Boston Globe is not a technology journal. It's a newspaper, okay? And so the tone of the article is going to be written in terms of the way the correspondent, the author, Lyle Denniston, who wrote the article in Boston Globe, is really going to be written with a tone based upon the information that he is given by the people he interviews. Is this not really true, Doc and Russ? You guys are authors of publications. You have a tendency of relying on your subject to tell you the truth.
Mm.
And so if you read this article, number one, it gives you the impression that this battle is fundamental to the success of open source technology, that it, this is really important, that if Windows doesn't win this battle, open source will be dealt a huge blow, and how Michael Robertson, the CEO of Windows, is somehow the advocate of open source, and so is therefore a de facto representative of the open source industry group. Now, I want to give Robertson his kudos where he is due them. They gave, what was it, the $200,000 award for the Xbox hack. So it's not like they haven't done anything. But bottom line, go to the Windows website. That's all I'm saying, is go to the Windows website, and nowhere on that website will you see a link to the source code for Windows. Okay? They are violating the GPL. Grossly violating the GPL. All of the links to source code are for things, are for products that are made by other companies. And it's links to, so it's links to Apache, links to Wine, links to, you know, you name Office Suite. But none of their own stuff. In terms of their own stuff, the Windows stuff, it's you buy the binary. And this is, in my opinion, is a gross violation of the GPL, and that Robertson and Windows is using the $200,000 award and articles like this as unabashed self-promotion to try and cast a false impression of importance upon his company, where the truth is, in my opinion, we won't even notice if Windows stops existing tomorrow, because we've got a lineup of very fine distributions that are doing quite well. So because of the story, Russ, and I know I'm getting a little emotional about this, it's because this guy Robertson just kicks me off to no end because of his ego of the way he runs his company.
I just looked up on I went to their FAQ. I was looking for where it might list something. I went to the FAQ, and if you look in the support section of the FAQ, if you do a search for GPL, it comes up with a question: does Windows OS comply with open source agreements? And the answer is absolutely. Windows.com is a strong supporter of open source software as organizations such as Debian and KDE through financial and other means. Some of the software programs are distributed under the GNU public general public license and other similar open source license agreements, yada yada. And it says, note, section one of the GPL license is available at.
Yeah, they basically say if you want it, go to Debian.
Yeah.
Okay? They're not given their source code. They're given Debian source code.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Is Windows based on Debian?
According to the information I have gotten both from the people at Windows and the people at CodeWeavers, who you recall used to work hand-in-hand with these people and canceled their contract with them.
According to what? Are they not based on Debian?
Well, I know the first version said it was powered by Zandros. Zandros is what's left of Corel Linux. Corel Linux was a Debian derivative. So, in looping terms, yes, they're based on Debian.
Yep. But the point is, regardless, there's no source code. Only binary, and you got to buy it. And so, again, gross violation of the GPL. So this insinuation about their company being the champions of open source is BS. It's BS. And, I really was happy for a long time of the fact that Windows has been around being a thorn in the side of Microsoft But you know what? There gets to be a point where you have to say you've got to get out of bed with people who aren't your friends. And so, therefore, I have contacted Lindo's this evening, this afternoon, and I have focused in on another product which, in terms of market niche, is nearly identical to the Lindo's product, at least in terms of the kind of client it's trying to appeal to and the features that the distribution has. And that other distribution is Licorice. Licorice supports GPL. Their binaries are available on their website. You don't have to buy nothing. And so they are, 100% in compliance with the GPL. So I have asked Robertson to come on our show late in February, or we'll give you an update on this if they will actually show up. I doubt they will show up. They've been invited about a dozen times and have never showed up. But we're going to run a head-to-head comparison between Lindo's and Licorice, and observance to the GPL aside, we'll do a quality comparison come late February, and I'm hoping that you will all spread the word to your friends to make sure that they listen to that segment, because I would much rather see the community support, if the product is virtually identical in terms of its functionality and market niche it's addressing, I would much rather see us give our support to a company that is doing the right thing for the community, not just doing $200,000 publicity stunts. I've had my say. Kevin?
Yes?
The rest of the show is yours. I'm out of here, everybody.
See you, man.
Good night.
Okay. See you, Jeff.
Bye.
There's some debate in the IRC room about whether the GPL is violated, and some of the people are saying that it's not necessarily so, if it is maybe sufficient to point to source code, and apparently in the My Lindo's account on thing, you can get the source code to the GPL stuff.
Now, has anyone actually bought it and seen what was available on the My Lindo's site?
Well, I imagine anybody can register on My Lindo's.
I don't know if you... Well, I think it does have a... In that... I'm off the page now, but in the FAQ, it does say you can get at it by signing up for My Lindo's. So,
and that might be a free... That indeed might be a free login.
I'll have to go over there and take a look, because I, at least at one point, had a valid username over there when I did the assessment of their original V1 box. But it's been a long, long time since I've touched anything of theirs.
Is it a free login there?
I don't know about that one, but I know with other things you have to, join their $99 or whatever it is now per year support group. So whether or not this is free or not, I don't know, quite honestly.
Someone needs to research that, I guess.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to take a look at that for next week, I guess. If we're dispensed with this, I can go on with the rest of the stories I have for the week.
Sure.
Second one I have here is a piece over at globetechnology.com, which is the online version of the Globe and Mail. And there's a nice piece called "Is Microsoft Courting Disaster?" Now, for most of the people who are probably listening to us right now, this piece is basically nothing new. However, the thing that strikes me about this is that this is an excellent business analysis of what's going on with Microsoft in the face of competition from Linux and other sources. And this strikes me as one of those pieces that would be very nice to show to your boss if you have a non-technical boss. They're looking at the bottom line, they're looking at the numbers, and they're looking at the business, and they're saying, well, Windows will be forever and ever, amen. This is actually a very nice piece from a business standpoint, saying No, you know, the business trends that they are embarking on and their business position currently really doesn't support them being in charge for much longer. They've got a real problem from a market standpoint, and they better do something to solve it. And considering that they're no longer the price leader, they can't even really fake it very well anymore, and they are still raising prices, which of course is one of those things that you know, smells like monopoly power to most people. It's a very interesting piece, and like I said, probably nothing new to most of the people listening, but it might be a very good tool to take into the office tomorrow morning.
Russ, but I must disagree. They are the price leader. They have the highest prices throughout across the board, and that's something they ought to be very proud of as a monopolist.
Well, actually, I can think of some that are higher priced, but
no, I mean application suites and stuff.
Yeah,
it's one of the things that it's interesting about this article is that the author cites Richard Smolensee, the dean of the MIT Economics School, Sloan Economics School, who was a Microsoft witness, pro-Microsoft witness during the antitrust trial. And if you remember the trial, what Smolensee was saying was that he was the one who argued that in spite of the fact that Microsoft was charging high prices, that Microsoft benefits users, therefore they should be allowed to continue their illegal activities somehow, I guess. And Smolensee his name is invoked in the article, which I had a laugh about, because, you know, this is the guy that basically said that it's all right to be a illegal monopoly if you somehow benefit somebody.
Well, everyone needs something good to do, I guess. I don't know.
A fatuous argument, I might say.
Yeah, it's good to see it turned around. I got another couple of quickies, unless someone else has something else they want to throw in on that one. One is that Turbo Power, which is not a company I've dealt with in the past, but apparently they've kind of made a name for themselves in the Delphi and I guess Kylix area for putting together all sorts of interesting widgets and pieces of code dealing with Delphi. Turbo Power is going out of business as a software company, but they are releasing their rather sizable library of somewhere around 1 million lines of code as open source. And I think that this is a very interesting situation, a good situation, because you know, the thing that so many people in the IT world dread is to have a business go out from under you and have your software go out from under you. Here, at least, even if the business is gone, the software has got a chance of surviving, because chances are, if these were reasonably popular programs, they're going to be taken up by the users of those programs and not allowed to die. And so this is a very good thing, and I hope that some other companies that may be dealing with their end times may also take this as a piece of advice to benefit the IT world. At that point in time, you got nothing to protect, so let it go, and let the community try to deal with the source code.
That is an extremely favorable set of events. Whether the tools are good or bad. I mean, I remember there's a couple of tools that I used to use. I used to use the Brief Editor, and Borland bought it up from the people, Underwear, who wrote Brief. It was a really good programmer's editor.
Mm.
And, of course, when Borland stopped supporting it, it just disappeared. I mean, you know, it would have been nice for them to have let somebody else pick it up, but no, it's gone.
Yeah, that's a big problem inside the closed source world. I mean, I've been on the receiving end of that in the past, too. It's no fun when things go away. And that is, once again, it reminds everyone else, too, and also something to remind your bosses, once again, in the morning. You go with open source. You won't have to hope that the source code becomes open source because it's already there. So, you know, it does give some security and some real security, especially since companies don't last forever. You know, I'm sorry. And then the last one that I have on the link on the front page is the debate that sort of raged for a while over on Slashdot a couple of days ago, beginning of the week, about some report over at Linux Business Week saying that SCO was considering charging Linux other Linux distributions $99 a shot for the use of their intellectual property. And you know, a careful reading of the initial article and some of the readings of the some of the responses that have been given makes me think that this is frankly more smoke than fire. I know that very well that in a large organization, people tend to throw around what-if memos pretty handily. You know, it's just kind of the way that thinking is done. And unless someone's got a plan, and SCO says that they don't have a plan to actually go about doing something like this, I don't think it's very likely. I think it would be a foolish move on their part for a number of reasons, including the fact that someone else pointed out inside one of the discussions over on Slashdot, you know, IBM apparently would not like it, and IBM has such a massive amount of intellectual property stored away that that they could certainly nail SCO or anyone else to the floor at some point in time.
And that has no credibility whatsoever.
Yeah,
I think it's just somebody. I have a feeling somebody in the legal department, you know, looked at. You know, let's see, Novell paid $1 million for this way back in 96, and, you know, we seem to have picked it up. What do we pay for? You know, who can we sue to get the value out of this?
Right.
And the memo goes out, and you know, privately a whole bunch of other people come back and say that's dumb. In the meantime,
right.
It gets leaked.
David Moring from New Zealand on the IRC channel earlier, and again just recently, just 30 seconds ago, has posted a link from an article on ZDNet News, e-business. The title of the article is SEO Fees May Hit Some Linux Users. And in that article, it becomes clear exactly what IP property SCO is attempting to protect. And that is, in particular, two Unixware libraries, which some Linux users are using as opposed to the GPL equivalents. And it is those libraries which SCO is trying to protect, not any GPL'd Linux sources. And it's only mostly their customers or those customers coming from Unixware who are using them. And this, thank you, David Moring. I appreciate your as usual, you got your link machine running well. He provides dozens of links every show on the IRC channel, and it's a great resource. But he did a pretty good job of fishing to get this article out here. And if you, I will, do you want me to email it? I can email it. You can put it up on the site.
I think this would be a good time for me to join in. Hi, it's Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
Hello, Bruce.
So, if you want to see a piece of messed up PR, this is messed up PR, because not only does it FUD customers about Linux, it FUDs customers about their own product.
Right.
So, I mean, and I've seen some messed up PR. I've had companies that I've been involved in do it. People really have to, first of all, prevent leaks. And if you get a leak, you have to say something unambiguous.
That's the real problem here. I mean, you know, somebody should have come out and said, I don't know what the hell that is, but that doesn't make any sense at all, you know, or something. But they didn't say anything.
And some of the things they said were actually counterproductive because the original response didn't say anything, did not clarify at all the situation.
Yeah.
And they looked really obtuse, and of course, all you have to do is leave things obtuse, and the flash dot effect takes over, and the confusions to which the slash dot crowd will jump is there's no end to it.
A lot of jumping to confusion.
Remember HP and the DMCA thing?
Oh, yes.
Where I just set fires under management, and we got that retracted in 24 hours. That is the way to do this.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You can do it less than that.
Well, at HP, that was a good job.
Yeah.
When you get a company that large, 24 hours is damn fast, believe me.
Well, I mean, now that ZDNet article it really makes it clear. But the title still has made no decision on Linux IP claims. I mean, geez, thanks a lot. No, that's, again, not really about.
I can't say for sure if they stop beating their wife.
Well, one last quickie, and I'll throw the ball back to Kevin. There's no link for it. This just hit my fax machine this week. And considering that Jeff just talked about the fact that the Linux Show is sponsoring these very nicely priced domain services. If anyone should get a fax from the domain support group, this group has been out there for over a year doing this, but apparently they're out there again, and they tried to hit me with it. They sent out this really legal-looking document that reads, in accordance with the United States legal code, Title 15, Section 1125, blah, 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 blah. And basically what it comes down to is that the .us domain is up for grabs again, or up for grabs now. And since I happen to own a .com, they sent me this wonderful thing saying the .us is available for the same name. And you know, unless I act now to prevent other people from getting hold of it by calling their 800 number, I could lose control. You know, this sort of thing, which is just a whole lot of nonsense. I mean, based on some of the stuff I've found on the internet since receiving this, apparently they try to get people to take out, you know, domain names for like 10 years at, you know, a couple hundred bucks or something like this. So, if you get hit with one of those, you know, just look up domain support group on Google, and you will find sufficient information to have yourself a good laugh. But it is, it's kind of crappy. Anyway, I'm done.
Doc, you got any stories?
I actually don't want to cut too much into Bruce's part of the show. I just say that I was at Macworld, and it was a major jaw-dropper when Steve Jobs said that they were basing their new browser, which is the one rumor that turned out to be true, that they were going to have a new browser. Everybody missed all the rest of them. And then it was going to be based on HTML, done by the KDE guys. And that was like, whoa. You know, the Linux guys in the audience, you could just sort of see the thought balloons over their heads saying, oh, my gosh, you know, it's Conqueror. Wow. You know, and so, and things kind of went nuts over at on the KDE lists. And I just sort of be interested in following up and seeing, you know, Apple went and turned over the code. And interestingly, all the guys doing that are ex-Linux guys there and Mozilla guys, including some key to Mozilla developers were involved in that, Easel guys. Things like that. So, and it's been a very wide open thing. It doesn't appear to have any of Apple's PR apparatus operating on it, which is a good thing. And it's kind of old news now, but I'm kind of interested in seeing what the net effects are, you know, in the Linux community, and what, you know, what's going to be done with this now that this, you know, one of the big commercial boys has picked up on it and played ball. So. I'll just put that out there. I don't think we necessarily have to talk about it, but I have a couple pieces about that and the X-Windows announcement as well, that they did some stuff with probably we should take a break and then turn the thing over to Bruce.
Okay, well,
don't forget Arnie.
Yeah, Arnie, any quick...
I can do mine real quick.
Okay.
Real quickly, I should say. There's been a couple articles recently, and this is just building up quite a head of steam on Linux on the desktop and you know, the challenge to Microsoft. In addition to the Globe and Mail article that was cited earlier, I found some things on the Seattle Times, which is interesting, right in Microsoft's backyard. Nimble Edge slowly erodes for Microsoft, and they're talking about Linux quite predominantly in this little article, and that link should be up on the Linux Show site. You might want to click on over to that, read that. I saw a column I think it was Linux Weekly News that talks about a grandmother who's installed a Linux on her box, and you know, basically a non-technical person, and basically it's more or less an ad for one of the Linux desktops, but it's a pretty good little article there. Also, Reuters has an article, Linux set to challenge Windows on the desktop, and this is an interesting one because they go into quite a bit of detail on some of the history, and again, this is mainstream press. Probably the best one is on ViewNet, and I think that link is also on the Linux Show site. It's called Microsoft Should Fear the Penguin, and this one cites a Goldman Sachs study which spells out, as they say, a stark warning to Redmond. And this one said, Goldman Sachs said that Linux will expand from running web or storage servers because of its reliability and the cheap hardware that it can be deployed on. It also expects Linux to become the dominant operating system on higher-end servers of the enterprise data center where mission-critical functions are run and most IT budget is spent. Goldman Sachs explained that Microsoft and traditional enterprise system vendors such as Sun, IBM, and Hewlett-Packard are at most at risk from the rise of Linux. But Linux will not take away market share from Microsoft in its traditional markets. However, it is our view that it will hamper the movement of Windows into the enterprise data center, an area Microsoft has only recently begun to target for growth. And again, this is these rumblings that are, each one of them means a little bit only, but it seems to be a groundswell of, you know, in the traditional press, of these kind of articles that is bringing, you know, gives no doubt that Linux is really making a head of steam now. Another article from the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, Why China Likes Linux. That link is also on the Linux Show site, and citing Mad Dog and a few other people in the Linux community, they talk about why China is really going to Linux, and this goes beyond the communist anti-capitalist pressures. And it's an interesting article, interesting read. I encourage people to click on over there. And I'll let Bruce come in then after the break then.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. So stick around and listen to tune. We'll be right back.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
Second segment of tonight's show, we have Captain Amazing Bruce Perrins on the air with us. Say hello, Bruce.
Captain Amazing? What am I supposed to be on Slashdot?
Well, something, I don't know. But
all right.
For people, well, let's put it this way. For people who don't know Bruce, use the link on the Linux show to read his bio. Otherwise, by the time we're done with the bio, the show will be over. Bruce is one of the old salts in the Linux world and has been around and around and around with many interesting adventures. The first question that I'm sure most people want to know, Bruce, is there life after Hewlett-Packard?
Oh, there's definitely life after Hewlett-Packard. I have to explain.
God, one would hope so.
Yeah, really. I have to explain that I am not in a SNIT. At HP. I was at HP for 2 years and 1 month, and those 2 years they paid me very well, and they pretty much let me do what I liked. Now, I had been told a whole year ahead that if the merger resulted in the compact guys running the Linux side of the company, that I would be out. Mm. And that prediction came true, so we pretty much knew that the compact guys were not of the corporate culture that would tolerate a Bruce Perens inside. And, you know, even with HP, 80,000 people before the merger, every week there was another email to Martin Fink, my boss at HP, entitled, "What is Bruce doing to us now?" and poor Martin essentially was my corporate apologist. And what happened was, in the merger, Martin got taken out of being in charge of Linux only, and he's sort of like CTO for business computing systems. It might even be a vice president position. So he profited from the merger, but he's not in a position where he can be my apologist any longer. But I would like to do some consulting for HP in the future. I don't know if it's possible, but certainly they're still a good company and they've got good Linux products.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Now, before we start talking about the Bruce Perren book series,
I have a line of luggage too, you know.
Okay, we'll wait for the scent to hit the stores next Christmas. You know, the Bruce Perren perfume.
And Ford is replacing Eddie Bauer interiors with mine and the new SUVs.
Can you tell us a little bit about your interesting landing at George Washington University and what that entails?
Okay, so George Washington University is a grant-funded position. That's the most important thing to know about it. I have to write grants and get them accepted by various funding agencies, including the U.S. government, in order to make any money there. So you can't really say that this is a job, at least not yet. If I had a reliable grant stream, it would be something else. So I wear approximately four hats. One is the Cybersecurity Policy Institute at George Washington University, where our mission is to participate in various ways in the development of the United States and possibly other nations. Cybersecurity. Cyber is a cool word, isn't it? And I thought these things were computers and networks. And so right now I'm finishing up a response to a comment that Microsoft filed with DISA, which is the Department of Defense's IT department. It's a comment on the 160-page MITRE study. And basically, I'm refuting some of the Microsoft arguments there. The MITRE study is an interesting piece. They actually held that back for 6 months. Microsoft was attacking MITRE and people at DISA about this and saying, you know, this libels us in various ways. And the final study, if you look in the attributions on the very first page, the first person in the attributions is Microsoft's general counsel. And that is because he harangued them so much and contributed so much changed text over those 6 months that he deserves first credit in the attributions. Okay, through all of this, the fellow was not able to get them to change the conclusion, which was that over there, they are making tremendous use of open source. And it's because of some issues that are very interesting. I used to work, this is going back to like 1980, I used to sell electronic paint systems, a company called CGL Inc. It was a division of my college, NYIT. And two of our customers were called the company and the farm. And this was CIA and NSA, and I was not security cleared. And they would call up with bugs. And because they were sending these bugs to these weird hippie Unix hackers, they would have to paint a non-sensitive picture to demonstrate every bug, where presumably these bugs came up while they were painting manuals on how to strangle people in Nicaragua. So, you know, here's a government agency, you know, hopefully protecting us. We cross our fingers. And they go through tremendous hardship to deal with a proprietary software vendor because they cannot communicate their data to that vendor, even under non-disclosure. And put open source software, free software, whatever, in that space. Okay, they can fix the bugs themselves. And I would assume that both CIA and NSA have some people at desks whose job it is to maintain some of the open source packages that we know they use. Now, I have a question regarding whether these bug fixes ever get back to us, but I'll live with that. Okay.
So it's not likely they're going to be selling the product for profit with their changes, so they won't be violating GPL.
You know, if you try to enforce the GPL on these guys, you could just disappear one day. So I consider it's my contribution to my country, and hope that they're using some piece of my software or something. And certainly they're using pieces of a lot of the rest of us. And so the conclusion of the study was that if these guys had to stop using open source software, they would be handicapped in defending our country. Now, why was this important? It was because of this Microsoft Mobile Internet Toolkit license, where it said you can't even use free software on the same computer. And they looked at that and said, well, gee, this license is not acceptable to the Department of Defense. So that was cool. There's also rumors that they had asked through our vice cybersecurity czar, who was the security officer for Microsoft, the head security officer before he went there. They asked DOD to ban the use of open source software, I'm told, because it wasn't secure, so they said. And they may actually have prompted this study by making that request, because obviously DOD doesn't do something without looking at the problem first. So it really blew up in their face either way, and I'm glad. So that's hat number one, is working on this sort of issue. Hat number two is GTPI, the Global Technology Policy Institute, which is my little lobbying organization that I would like to be more than just me someday. You can go see what we're doing there at techp.org, techp.org. And that's collected a few thousand dollars so far, and essentially all of that has gone to pay for airline and hotel bills as I've been flying around defending the faith. I've been to a ridiculous number of countries lately. Unfortunately, HP is not paying for me to go there anymore, and neither sometimes are the conferences. So that's been helpful. And then there's my book line, which you'll be hearing more about. And there is my consulting firm. I consult on policy to companies that want to be good open source and free software citizens. And I, while at HP, developed the corporate open source policy with people there and was a founding member of their open source review board, which essentially says, can we use this? Are we in compliance with the license? Can we release this? That's the kind of questions they deal with. And, of course, there's the contamination problem. Will we give away all our intellectual property because we're using the GPL? Simple answer is no, but we have a review board to make sure we're not doing that.
Right.
So now that I'm no longer doing that at HP, I am helping other companies go through the same process. And then the book line.
The book line. Yes. Can you tell us, what about this strange, un-American, communistic book thing that you're doing here, giving away books? What is wrong with you, Bruce?
Well, actually, we're selling books. And in fact, I didn't have enough time to check out the borders because my two-year-old was dragging me around. But I've checked out two Barnes & Nobles locally and have seen both of the released books in the Perrin's book series in both of those retail stores. So I think they're going to be in a retail store near you if you've got a Barnes & Noble, and you will pay $49.95 for these books. Now, approximately 3 months after they are in the retail stores, we release these in electronic form. And the paper version currently is under the Open Publication License 1.0 with none of the optional features. And the electronic version will be under the same license. Now, why 3 months? The 3 months is so that the retail pipeline is saturated. Mm-hmm. And people who've gone right out and bought this already have it. And there is less incentive for another publisher to just come out with cut-rate versions of these and get them in the retail stores, because retail stores say, well, we already have them.
Gee, Bruce, what's the title of the first book?
Okay, so these are embedded software development with ECOS. What's ECOS? And the Linux development platform. So ECOS is a really interesting topic here. This is yet another kernel. So how many free kernels do we have? We have FreeBSD in the herd and Linux, and then we have a couple little experimental things, and ECOS. ECOS is for smaller devices than Linux. It is a tightly embedded runtime kernel. It's actually the basis of Red Boot. That's where I think a lot of people would.
Isn't that the one that without the MMU?
I think so. I'm not sure. I think you can do this with an MMU. But it's generally meant to be, I think, single address space. And it has networking, etc. We even have a Linux without an MMU today.
Yeah, there's the Micro C Linux.
So we have the only book, essentially, on the topic. And it's a book that is free software as well, and that will continue and that the community can contribute to. Now, will I become filthy rich from this? Obviously, you all want to know. The answer is no. I make a whole buck if they sell at full price. If they sell it less than full price, I might not make anything. And the printing business is actually very short run these days. 5,000 is a good run for a technical book, and 20,000 is a smash hit. So I'm not expecting to have smash hit after smash hit. And thus, it would be nice if this book series would pay for some of those plane flights and hotel bills too, so that I don't have to go out and beg the community for help with that. But this isn't even going to support my family. So then there's the Linux development platform is a... it's more like a textbook, but this is not a textbook line. Prentice Hall has a different division that makes textbooks. These are technical books. And it's good for someone who's just getting to Linux, like a college freshman, for example. It says what all the tools are, that you can do all different sorts of programming. The next book to come out is Intrusion Detection with Snort. So that's intended for sysadmins.
Okay. Now, just to make things clear, you're not the one authoring these books, correct?
I am not the author of any of the books. In fact, these books I haven't even written a foreword for. I have to write more forewords. But I am the series editor, and that gives me a lot of latitude to be involved in different ways. The way I choose to be involved is in the book acquisition. In other words, getting the authors to write for us and working on their outlines and their topics with them. And also setting the overall policy for the books, which was these have to be licenses that that could be certified to the Debian Free Software Guidelines or the open source definition.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in the case of the Open Publication License, there are two options to that license that we cannot use because it would make it non-open source. One is no commercial printing. The other is no substantive modification. So we don't check those boxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, one of the obvious questions here is how does Prentice Hall make money off of this? Is the idea that short run, like you were saying, of a few thousand books would be more or less the same whether or not it's an open license or a closed license? Is that where the money is being made for the publisher?
The dynamics, the revenue scheme of these books are exactly like any print book at Prentice Hall. And what we're seeing here is something we saw with a couple books which were quietly under the open publication license and came from the same division and I think even the same executive editor at Prentice. Authors had asked for that. They'd legal reviewed the OPL before they started talking with me, and they'd used it, and it hadn't made a difference in their revenues as far as they could tell.
Mm.
So, or if it made a difference, it was a positive one.
Mm.
So we're reasonably confident that the free delayed version will not cause Prentice to lose lots of money. Now, $49 for a book, obviously it doesn't cost $49 to print it. What we're paying for is editorial expenses, including the author. The author, I think, makes something between 8 and 10, probably more like 8, on a full-price book. Thus, this is not a way for authors to get rich either. I am looking for more authors, and the benefit for them are, first of all, doing open-source documentation, and second, there's a lot of prestige. It helps you in your job as a consultant, etc., and a good deal of personal gratification.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've fixed a lot of the things that are wrong with traditional book publishing in this series, because publishers were not giving authors electronic rights. Here we have them. And the authors were having their books remaindered. They were just going to the discount rack. They weren't printed again. And the authors had no control. They couldn't do a reprint. They couldn't do a next edition because often the copyrights did not revert to them. Now, these are books that can live forever. The author can self-publish. They can do it either electronically or in print under the licenses on these books.
Hmm. That's interesting. Did you have any difficulty getting Prentice Hall to buy off on this concept, or was it, like you said, since it didn't seem to be costing them any money, they decided that they would just go ahead and do it?
Well, you know, I think Prentice was looking for me. And they were looking for someone who could be the anti-Tim, the anti-Tim O'Reilly, or they were looking for the Peter Norton of Linux.
Yes.
So I'm one of those. They wanted a brand. So, like, you remember in the movie I said all these things were so weird I thought I was on drugs. My life is just like that. From being a hacker, I am now a brand name. And it's really strange. There is a trademark registration just because I did not want to have what happened to that Nissan guy where the Nissan Motor Company came and took away his domain.
Oh, jeepers.
So Perrins is actually in a two-stage trademark filing. There's this kind of filing that you can do before you use it in business. And that stage is finished, and then the second stage is currently happening right now. So it's Bruce Perrins TM.
Wonderful. Bruce, there's a question from the IRC channel.
Uh-huh.
David Mooring, who's a very, very strong supporter of the Linux show and and provides our many, many, many topical links on the IRC channel. And if he wasn't in New Zealand, he probably could be a co-host. He's saying, what about open community development of next year, second and following editions, and following editions of the books?
I think that if authors want to do open community development, they can. I know that some authors do their open community development under a more restrictive license, with the stated intention that the work will go DFSG free once it's released. And that means that the publisher who's paid them some number of thousands of dollars in advance does not have the rug pulled out under them by another publisher. So structuring the license is something that takes a little tuning. At the same time, there are a number of books that have been open developed without the intention of submitting them to a publisher at all, that we're seriously looking at. So I think there's room for negotiation here. And if someone said they absolutely wanted to do everything free, and including for commercial printing, from the first word that we'd look at the offer. We haven't taken up one like that yet, but obviously I want to be true to the ethos as well as I can while not having everyone connected with this go broke at the same time. Have you guys seen Wikipedia?
You could be Corel then if you did that, though.
Well, I'd be any Linux distribution. So have you guys seen Wikipedia?
Wikipedia? No, I haven't.
Wiki, wikipedia.org. Okay. This is something that totally blew my mind. I was out on Google the other day, and I had a question. Do almonds contain cyanide? And it turns out that bitter almonds do. So I typed this into Google, and up comes this great, incredibly studious, well-written encyclopedia article on almonds. And at the very bottom it says, this article is under the GNU Free Documentation License. And I go, say what? And so this project is wikipedia.org, which is a free software encyclopedia with 80,000 articles that they're currently working on.
Good heavens.
And it's a great example of entirely free texts done through collaboration and self-governing. For example, I went to their chapter on 9/11, where obviously there's controversy, and they managed to report it in a balanced fashion and not have people go crazy. And you can go on this thing and just start typing in to the articles, because the entire encyclopedia is a wiki.
Hmm.
And so I'm bringing this example up with the press, because just as a few years ago, if someone had said, oh, we'll just make an operating system in our spare time and take over the world with it, people would have said, yeah, you're smoking the wrong kind of pot. And today, if someone said, oh, we'll just write an encyclopedia in our spare time, most people would say the same thing. And yet, these guys are doing just a great job. And I would encourage everyone who has an area of expertise, however obscure, to contribute it to the Wikipedia.
They also have the Wiktionary, which is the same thing of a dictionary. And they also have, this is wonderful, Sourceburg.
Sourceburg?
Sourceburg, yes. Sourceburg is the Wikipedia answer to the Project Gutenberg.
Okay.
And they are trying to duplicate the sources of Project Gutenberg on the Wikipedia website as well. This is a great website. I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay, so
it really is a useful encyclopedia.
Gutenberg has kind of funny idea about licensing, so I'm glad someone is doing that. So It's really funny. You can have it in its public domain, but you can't use their name unless you put this weird blurb in Gutenberg Works.
Oh yeah, I mean,
it's
like
very old, and it kind of precedes all this free software stuff that we've been doing.
Yeah.
But more about the book series. So we've been getting just incredible press. The New York Times, radio shows, all kinds of stuff. And mostly on the copy this book, it's legal angle. That's a shocker to most people. And it gets headlines, it gets authors to write it, and it gets the articles in. And this is what I find, is that once you get your foot in the door with that, you can start explaining about open source, and once they're asking for a while, you can even start talking about freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that things like this book series get in the mainstream press, not just the Linux press, so that the world can see that, yes, this is a viable way to do things. Now, I have a radio show coming up. I can't talk about with who yet, but one of the things that I will do is invite the audience to participate in the Wikipedia, because here's a free software project that pretty much anybody who can make an essay can participate in.
Hmm. Well, another question that comes to mind about all this, though, is that, okay, now you're dealing with technical manuals on one hand, and then we see this similar effort with some reference works like the dictionary and the Wikipedia and so forth. Does it make sense to go beyond references with this sort of licensing? The question, I guess, that Jeff put together is, does it make sense to do Harry Potter this way? Where do you see this whole notion of open licensing of books going?
Okay, so it makes sense to do first books that way economically. Some of you have heard of the Vantage Press. Vantage Press is what's called the Vanity Press.
Mm.
And they are a dead tree publishing house for self-publishing. And they also call it, I think, subsidized press or subsidized publishing. People would pay some number of thousands of dollars, and they would end up with a closet full of their books. Okay, so the dead tree method of doing this, I would assume, is probably going to be one of the casualties of electronic publishing. And here, again, is an area where you don't have to do digital rights management on it. So people can view it on any system that they like. They can make it speak it to the blind people, etc. But we can't kid ourselves. We have not yet been able to succeed with the street performer protocol. We haven't really gotten anyone to make a living from making works with the street performer protocol. I hope more people try. And we may need a proprietary economic model, even in electronic self-publishing. Now, a lot of people I know are electronic self-publishing and making money with extremely small press runs because they charge, oh, half of what a print book would cost, and they essentially pocket everything.
Right.
Because they're doing it right off of their own website, where in this case, Prentice does get the majority, and I suppose splits it with the bookstore, and the author gets, oh, 20%. And I get 2%.
Well, if the author's making 20%, that's an unusually good deal.
Okay, so because the author may well make 5%.
I think,
okay.
I think like 8 to 10, it seems to
yeah.
be fairly standard.
So,
and that's off of wholesale, not off of retail.
Yeah. So, again, do not expect to get rich that way. This note to myself, too. And, but some people I know who are doing this just as cottagey publishers say that they're doing reasonably well, and I think that at least some of them don't bother with DRM, and their readers buy their stuff. And, you know, they just don't have people circulating them unauthorized.
It's kind of expensive to be circulating Dead Tree books.
Yeah, but you know, you can't curl up with an e-book yet.
We can't.
When we have those flexible LCDs or something, and also fuel cells, so that they'll be nice and bright, that'll be the case, or maybe when they just download to your brain. But we don't see an end to paper at the moment, and that's important because the economic model that I am using would not work if you did not need paper. We've got to be honest with ourselves here. The free as air won't necessarily work for us. So in this case, we've been able to do free software just because of the way the market works, because we could still make our money on paper. But we still have to keep looking. And, you know, I was sitting next to Stallman at a panel with a lot of government people in Washington, D.C., and Richard said, well, I think that for print publications, they don't necessarily have to have all of the rights that we use for free computer software. And my jaw dropped, and I turned to Richard, and I said, Richard, that was extremely reasonable of you. In front of 200 or 300 people in the audience. So it may end up that the dynamics of free e-books are not the same as free software, and maybe one of these Creative Commons licenses that is less than fully open source or DFSG compliant.
Well, considering it's about 20 minutes past the hour, do you have any closing things that you want to leave us with here?
I am just so blown away. You know, I got into this in 1993. I actually wrote Electric Fence in 87 and made it free, and that was cool, but got into Linux development in 1993. And if anyone had told me that all of this stuff would happen, I would have just said, no, you are crazy. And when anyone says to us, well, you know, why haven't you displaced Microsoft yet? You just have to look back and think about, what have we done in 10 years, and isn't this incredible?
Right.
And if we were to maintain even half that rate, what would we be doing in the future? So I would encourage people to continue to make free software and free media. Get on that wiki. And in my case, and I hope for most people, every hour that I put into this has paid it back. Paid back 10 times over. Not necessarily in money, but it's come back to me. And I'm not sure it works that way for everyone. I wish it did, but try it. It sure worked for me.
Hmm.
Well, what's interesting is the Linux, anybody who doubts Linux or the open source community's contribution should consider that the smallest computers in the world and likewise, the largest computers in the world all run Linux. That's pretty amazing.
Have you been in the airport lately?
No, not recently.
I'm told that some of these airport, the big expensive luggage scanners have Linux in them.
Oh, it's no doubt.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. And
the post office uses it.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, every piece of mail in the United States Post Office.
Wow. So it's just incredible, everything that's going on. And I just remember all of the stuff that I was hearing in, like, 1996 about, you know, this is a toy, it's not professional, it will never be real. And Steve Jobs, I used to work down the hall from Steve, and he would, in 1999 when I left there, I walked into his office and I said, well, Steve knew I was leaving. Do you still not believe in this Linux stuff? And he said, well, you know, I had a lot to do with making two of the world's great GUIs, by which he meant NextStept and the Mac desktop. And he said, it takes a billion-dollar research organization to make those. And just seeing Steve with that slide the other day that says, open source, we think it's great, at the Macworld conference. And just going, oh, yeah, Steve? So, I this is very self-congratulatory, but we've got to pat ourselves on the back once in a while. We have done incredible stuff that no one could have expected.
That's quite true. We've come a long, long way, and we still got more to do, but
yeah,
it's good sometimes to stop and look over your shoulder and realize what you've accomplished.
And the other thing is, much as I get lots of credit, this is the community effort, and I never kid myself that I'm any kind of star. I'm just somebody who speaks out for a community.
Don't forget BusyBox, though.
BusyBox is cool, but do you know Eric Anderson did much more work on BusyBox than
that? But it's a nice, it lives on in the Zoris. And
yeah, I've got one sitting right here, in fact.
Yeah, me too.
And, yep. I mean, there were other people. Remember Dave Sinedge?
Yeah.
Dave was doing the Linux router project for a number of years and did...
It's still there, too.
A lot of stuff on BusyBox as well, and thus... I probably have less than one-fifth of the code in BusyBox by program count, and probably less than that by actual Bruce code left in the thing.
But that's the way open source works, Bruce.
Yeah, so what I say when people ask about BusyBox is, I wrote this all in a month, and at the end of the month, it was a self-sustaining open-source community, and I did not have to touch it again. And that is what is worth being proud about.
Okay, well, I think we're well past our time now. Thank you, Bruce, for joining us this evening.
Okay.
It's been a great time, and best of luck with all that you're doing.
Okay.
Kevin, you want to take us home?
Sure. Okay, just like to thank Bruce and the regular crew.
Take
Jeff,
it easy.
Arnie, Russ, Doc, and myself, and we'll be back next week. So until then, keep using Linux, and we'll be back next week.
So you need a Memail server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? Well, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.